Hello, my name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela, and this is Wicks and Candles, a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
We want to dig into a selection of period films, and while we review them, find out why we love them and what effect they have on us.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wicks and candles.
In this episode, Maurice.
We are back in England this time, Nene, and back to a time where we've been before in our previous series of podcasts. So we're back into the early 20th century.
We are reviewing Maurice, a film that has a lot of parallels to A Room with a View, which was the first film we talked about in our first season of Wicks and Candles.
Totally. And I was surprised myself while watching the film. Because I didn't really know that it would be so full of parallels. So let me give you the main facts of the movie, and then we'll find out which are the similarities.
Great.
So Maurice is a British romantic film from 1987. And this is based on a novel by the same name, Maurice, written by E.M. Forster. And this is the first parallel that we find. E.M. Forster also wrote A Room with a View. What is interesting about Maurice is that this novel was published in 1971. But Mr. Forster had written this novel long, long before, nearly 60 years before, and it was only published after he passed away. He was kind of hesitant while he was alive whether he should publish it at all. So now comes the next thing that this film has in common with A Room with a View. It was directed by James Ivory and, surprise, surprise, was also produced by the Merchant Ivory production team. We will certainly talk about that later, what effect the choice of director and producers had on the film. But before we go into that, let me name you the main cast. So we see James Wilby as Maurice, Hugh Grant as Clive, and Rupert Grave, who was also playing a role in A Room with a View, as Alec. And there are also a few other actors that that had a little role in the previous film, like Delholm Elliott as Dr. Berry. And even Helena Bonham Carter had a very, very short cameo on this film.
Wow. Wow, that's truly a lot of parallels.
It's like siblings movies.
Yeah.
Totally, yeah. The film was... It is very impressive. It is such a good film. We will certainly talk about it later. But it wasn't such a heavily awarded film. The films that we have reviewed so far in Wicks and Candles are usually darlings among the critics. But this one has a very short list of nominations and awards. It was very successful at the Venice Film Festival in 1987. And the curious thing about it is that James Wilby and Hugh Grant, they both received the award for Best Actor.
Wow.
Which didn't really happen, I guess, ever again. James Ivory got the award for Best Director and Richard Robbins for the music. And the costume design was nominated for the Oscars. But that's pretty much it.
That is interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a very iconic film, and obviously it was a little bit on the radar for the critics in that year on the festivals. So that's pretty much the hard facts, Nene. How about some hints on the plot?
Yes, thank you, Gabby. So Maurice tells the story of Maurice Hall, a student at Cambridge who falls in love with his aristocratic friend, Clive Durham. The story is set in 1909 and is a tale of gay love in the restrictive and repressive culture of Edwardian England. So the story follows Maurice through his university years and later he struggles to fit into society and ultimately live an honest life. So that's a very brief description of the plot. Much more happens, of course, but that's about right in terms of what happens in the story. So, Gabby, yes. This is another Merchant Ivory production. What do you think is their trademark? And first of all, before we actually go into that, why did we choose Maurice?
Why did we choose Maurice? And I think subconsciously, we were attracted by the trademark of the Merchant Ivory production. I think we have mentioned this before in our episode about A Room with a View. We were in love with the entire atmosphere that this film portrays and conveys. And I think when we saw the trailer for this film, we were immediately fascinated again by this, by the time, by the atmosphere, that it takes place in England again, and it's a, you know, it's like a college yeah. setting, you know. So many elements that we kind of recognized from past love, and that got us hooked again.
Yeah, definitely. I think for me, it was all of those things that you mentioned. And for me, there was also the motivation that I have was that even though we've seen A Room with a View many times and other Merchant Ivory films like Remains of the Day, this one came up appearing everywhere, and I have never find my way to watch it, so I had never seen it. This was the very first time, so I've seen it a total of one time to talk about it in the podcast. And I think it was just sort of like a little bit of homework. Like, if we love these movies and we love Merchant Ivory, we have to watch this one as well. Because everywhere you read about period films and this particular time where Merchant Ivory were doing these adaptations, this was one that was mentioned as being a very important one.
Yeah, very iconic one. Yeah, it was like a missing piece on the puzzle.
Yes,
that we had to fit in. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely,
totally, Nene.
Yeah. So, after you watch Maurice, what do you think? What did the Merchant Ivory strike again? Because yes. they made it just 2 years after A Room with a View. A Room with a View was made in 1985, and then 1987 they made Maurice,
and this is what kind of I would identify as their kind of their brand. First of all, obviously, I don't know if it's Merchant Ivory Productions or because both stories are from the same author. They both take place by the early 20th century. So it is a fascinating time. It has, again, this carefree kind of, pace in life. Mm. Yeah. You know, everything is just about to collapse before the First World War. But it's just like in this kind of shiny moment of aristocracy where everything is kind of, still going with the flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it has that atmosphere again. And well, Nene, I think what characterizes Merchant Ivory production is the absolute and impeccable love to detail. Mm. So the entire setting is so incredibly well done. each room where they that they use as a setting of a scene, it is full of detail. So with the light, with the decoration, with the costumes and so on, with the furniture they use, you really feel like they took someone's house from that time and just said, just wait a minute, we're going to film a scene here. Yeah. That's the feeling you get when you see such a scene in one of the of the big houses that they filmed at, or in Cambridge in the reading rooms where they took some lessons. It is all so well decorated that you really feel transported to that time, to that moment, to those days. Yeah. And this is something that we love about period films. This is the feeling that we want to get, to be transported to another time, to be taken out of reality and put somewhere else.
Yeah.
And they achieve that perfectly with exactly this combination. And it might look at sometimes it might look like it's a little bit overwhelmed with, you know, too much porcelain, too many books on the shelves, too many tables, chairs, carpets, lamps, wallpaper. Yeah. But in the combination, it has exactly the perfect character that an atmosphere that you need to have the impression I am witnessing something that happened in 1909 in England.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. The trademark Merchant Ivory production design, costume design, so all the visual aspects are there in this movie as well as they were in A Room with a View. The feeling is a little bit different because while A Room with a View is very much more a female story, although we do have two characters, male and female. This is much more. No, this is an entirely male story,
totally
male-driven story, right? So the feeling is a little bit different because, you know, the rooms are not necessarily rooms kept by women. So the feeling is a little bit different. You have college dorms and reading rooms that are for boys, for men, for the dean and so on. So the rooms are much more masculine. But this all adds to the pleasure. A glimpse into another world that we don't necessarily get all the time. But all the visual trademarks are there, like impeccable costume design. This team, Jenny Beaven and John Bright, they were rightly nominated for an Oscar in 1988. The thing with the costumes is that they feel, they don't distract you. They really feel well worn, they blend with the story seamlessly. You are not in any moment thinking of the clothing as, you know, look at this, look at that. It's just so perfectly inhabited by the characters.
Yes,
it doesn't take you out of the movie in any way. And a particular thing that I love was just seeing all those tweed jackets and those pants. Just beautiful clothing,
so
because
beautiful.
You know the beautiful clothing that these two aristocratic boys would wear, in particular going to university in Cambridge. So the other aspect, that another trademark that the movie has, is, like as you said, there's so many parallels with A Room with a View because there's a lot of the actors in minor roles. And in an interview that I was watching with James Ivory, he was saying that essentially when they had their production company, they had kind of like this company of actors that they will kind of call back again and again. And that's why it makes, you know, it's like you see the same faces, the same actor, Simon Callow, a small little role for Helena Bonham Carter. And then we have, Rupert Graves, in actually very important role.
Nene, and you have mentioned something that I totally agree with, this masculinity. And also as a comparison to A Room with a View, because I hadn't seen it like that. But of course, I realized, okay, this is a very manly film. There are very few female characters in the film, and they play a secondary role.
Yeah.
And how you combine it with the surroundings. Yeah. The colors are darker. And
yeah.
Everything is a little bit more somber. Yes, of course. Totally interesting. And what would say, okay, again, here, if the men are playing the main roles, how is it like, how much can you really make out of the costumes, yeah, with the men's attire? One of my favorite costumes that they wore was when they were playing cricket.
Oh, my God.
At the cricket game. The white shirts and the linen pants. Oh. And that's where what you mentioned before, and I agree totally, 200% with that, it looks so natural how they move in the clothing, how they just wear the clothing.
It's just as if
you were really looking through a peephole into 1909 students' life of Cambridge.
Yeah. You know what? I and this is a completely entire conversation, separate conversation, but I often struggle in science fiction with the costume design. Because, you know, in science fiction, designers have a lot of freedom to create a different world, right? A different world that doesn't exist. And they create this very complex makeup or hairdos. And I always think, okay. So how is this grounded in reality? What are the reasons that the hair is being worn this way in the year, 2071, or, 10,000 years into the future? And it takes me out of the story, because I keep thinking, okay, so this person woke up and made this, painted her face white and made this humongous, I'm thinking of Star Wars, I'm thinking all kinds of things. Like, what is the reasoning behind certain decisions, right? And with a period film, it can happen as well. Like, if you go well into the past, like if we go to 16th century or before, especially when we're talking about the aristocracy with elaborate costumes that had a lot of meaning in what they, clothing
they represented.
Clothing was very coded in terms of, colors and in terms of fabrics that you could and could not wear and so on. So there's a distancing that happens both with movies that take place in the future for me, but also movies that take place very much into the past, because I keep thinking, okay, so this person woke up and made a decision to wear all of this and how. But in this movie, maybe because it's closer to our, it's just 100 years ago, and it's just because of how exquisitely researched and accomplished these costumes are, that you truly understand the reasoning behind this clothing. You can see these people walking around, going about their business. There's a few, and I think it's striking in this movie because it's, again, a very male movie. It's mainly male characters.
Yeah.
And their movements are not as restricted as women's character, like we saw in A Room with a View or other period films where women's movements are very restricted in what you can and cannot do, should or should not do. Men here, they play sports, they run around, they row boats, they do sports, they play with each other and tumble on the ground. They're very active, and the clothing just, does all of that. And I think that's what is very striking about how good this world is, how well they create this universe.
They recreate
this past for the viewers.
And also, they also show a lot of the underwear, which is also rare to see. A lot of the underwear. And also with which ease the actors, of course, the figures, they dress and undress, including underwear, as if they had done it all their lives.
yeah, with the naturality that really put you.
Absolutely. You really feel transported.
Yeah.
With every detail. And I think, this is what makes them special, these films.
Yeah.
Nene. And not only that, not only the visuals, not only this feeling of transportation to Back to the Past, we have to admit that the performances of both Hugh Grant and James Wilby were an absolute eye-catcher. They made the film.
Oh, absolutely. God. Okay. What? I'm losing my mind a little bit here. I'm losing my mind here a little bit. Why don't you go ahead first? What do you think of the performances between Hugh Grant and James Wilby? So Hugh Grant was quite young, obviously.
Hugh Grant, I am very sorry. I didn't research how young he was back then, but I was impressed by his beauty. I mean, I have seen many films with Hugh Grant my life. And of course, I know he's handsome. So I had already taken that in, you know, for granted. Okay, Hugh Grant is a handsome actor. But with this film, it was not just handsomeness, it was beauty.
Oh.
It was a porcelain face.
Oh.
In contrast to his wavy black hair, I was completely in awe.
Oh my God. Okay.
Oh, so
I just looked it up. He was 27. He was 27 when he made this movie, but he looks much, much younger.
He looked like 23. Well, yeah, but of course.
And I think they're playing younger too, because they're in their early years at Cambridge. They're younger. And then they age and
yes, and become adults.
Face changes a little bit. He gets a mustache and so on.
He gets a mustache.
But he would have been 27 or 26, 27 when they were filming this movie. Yeah.
Captivating face.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't really acknowledged. As I said, I of course I've seen many of his films. And he was like, okay, a pretty face. But I don't know. I had never really been...
Yeah,
all of the radiation of his beauty. And I think it's made. Of course, he is a very handsome man. But I think they made him, of course, with a hairdo. With a hairdo, oh, I don't know. They made him look more shiny. I don't know.
Oh, my God. Okay, let me tell you. Okay,
Go ahead.
Let's stay with Hugh Grant for a minute here.
Let's stay with Hugh Grant.
Then we can move to James Wilby. Yes, I think what happens is... we have seen so many movies with Hugh Grant, and we were quite young when these early movies came out. So if this movie came in 1987, you were 7, I was 11. So we obviously, this movie, we didn't know anything at all, nothing about it, nothing at all. So again, I've only watched it now because it's been on my radar for a long time. So it really is like a throwback to the earliest roles for Hugh Grant. And not only was he beautiful, because it's not that you forget, you always see him, he's wonderful. Yeah. His face is full of character, and he's always played the handsome romantic partner. That's kind of the roles he plays, a romantic partner, usually is a handsome person. But I agree with you that the way he was filmed in this movie, the way he was shot, like the camera, how it shows him as an object of love, elevates him. And his performance, and now we can move on from his physical look. I mean, he was beautiful, but I think it would be worthless if his performance wasn't as good as it is. His performance is very, very subtle, and you said serious, which is unusual. We now see him more in a comedic kind of the clumsy comedic role. He's playing straight. He's playing, the serious, just a young student at Cambridge, and he's very idealistic too. He reads Plato and he talks about philosophy.
He plays music. But I mean, this is what was so striking for me to see Hugh Grant in this film, that he, for the first time, at least the films that I know that he has made, I finally saw him playing a serious role, because we know him as the clumsy romantic comedian kind of guy, who's like, you know, very shy, kind of insecure, a bit of humorous. He's always very humorous in his roles.
Yeah.
And I hope we're not doing him too much of, we're not being too unfair to Hugh Grant. And this is maybe what really took me by surprise. This role was completely, it was an adult role. It was serious. It was straight to the point. He was being, you know, he was not fooling around, the character, no. Of course. And somehow they really managed to get this humorous part out of him. And you completely fall for his charm. Obviously, he had to look very attractive and he had to look very beautiful for James Wilbiel to fall for his charm, or the character, Maurice, to fall for his charm. So I think there is a certain intention on making Hugh Grant look so handsome, you know, so attractive. And with this seriousness, you know, he's always like, he has like a slightly naughty look, but he never goes into comic. He's very serious because it's kind of a somber story. It's not a happy-go-lightly
kind of story.
It's a somber story.
It is.
He was just excellent. And this role shows what kind of quality he has as an actor. And it's actually, I don't know, I would have to review his further career to see if I find something else within his filmography that kind of has this touch. Because it is kind of sad that he obviously can play these serious roles so incredibly well. And we, as a viewer, have been putting him in the drawer of he's the clumsy romantic comedian kind of guy.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I will say his later roles. His more recent roles, like a couple years, in the last two years, he's played some fantastic, more serious roles, more acerbic or more, you know, just different, because he's older now and he's just brilliant. I mean, he's from that British school of acting that is, you know, all about the face and the little gestures in the face and the looks and the little movements of the body. I mean, it's just, he's very much of that school and he's still excellent. Yeah, I guess for a while he decided to go into that route, right? The romantic hero. He did movies with Julia Roberts, and but there's a lot of beloved films with him in it.
So. I mean, I like him, and he is very good at
what he does.
Obviously, because he wouldn't be so successful. And I really, really do like him. But you know, to see him in something so contrasting as from his blockbusters was absolutely refreshing, and it was absolutely for me like an eye opener.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was a fantastic performance and a treat. Now let's move on to James Wilby, who plays Maurice. What do you think of him?
Very well. I don't know him. I didn't know him as an actor. I cannot also say whether I ever saw him again in another film. Also very well, because you feel so much of his uncertainty. So he obviously managed to convey his feelings, his struggles completely through the viewer. And what I found nice about he being cast as Maurice is exactly this, how they perfectly found the... this contrast between the self-confident playboy kind of, you know, man of Clive,
yeah,
and the beauty of Hugh Grant, and Maurice was the more insecure. He was handsome, but he was not especially beautiful, you know. And how to portray this contrast, yeah, more insecure, more kind of shy.
Yeah,
guy, in contrast to this very self-confident and
That is interesting. I didn't think of that, but it's true. They balance each other very well. No,
like yin and yang. Yeah.
Yeah, and same as you, I didn't know James Welby, and we probably have seen him in other things, but I can't remember. I'm sure I've seen him somewhere else, but here he's very young, wonderful. I mean the hair.
Oh my gosh, the wavy hair.
The hair in this movie is just like to die for. The haircuts of the man. Bring them on. I want them.
Gorgeous. I'm just gonna mention again the scene of the cricket game because the hair. the wavy curls of Morris against the sunlight in the cricket game was just,
oh my god. Yeah, I agree. No, and they start to sweat and the haircut, there's lots of hair, like so much luscious hair, like, oh my god. And it's moving in the when they run. Just if you love male hair, this movie for you. It's a lot of gorgeous hair.
And maybe the most iconic scene that we watches of this film.
Can we leave
include
it for
include some hair?
Exactly. The most iconic scene of Maurice includes
hair.
Includes hair, and we'll touch on it in just a minute. But yes, let's close here. Let's finish our comments on James Welby. I agree that he's the most insecure. He's not poor. He's going to Cambridge. He's also from the aristocracy, but he is. They are fundamentally different, and I think this is essentially the story of the movie, how both of them deal with the fact that their instincts are different from what is expected of them in society, and both of them go in a different way. So he plays this very well. I think there's a particular scene that I was extremely impressed by him, is when maybe I'm giving it away, maybe we can move on to the next section, and it's just the way he plays pain, the way he portrays pain, dissolution, confusion, hurt. It's devastating,
absolutely. Yeah. And this is his achievement.
Yeah.
He perfectly conveys the struggles of a man, a homosexual man of those days. He perfectly conveys that to the viewer.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the third topic that we want to touch, which is the historical context of the movie and the topic of homosexuality. So it's a love story between two young men. At a time when homosexuality was illegal in England. And this plays a very important part in the plot, because the threat of the law of being caught, of being shamed and sent to jail is ever present. Like, the threat, the fear of this shadow of the law is ever present in their lives, in their movements, in everything they do. So what do you think,
Nene,
of
this was so compelling. This really took, this moved me so much. This is the core of the story. It's a gay love story in times where this was not supposed to happen. And even though the movie or the story, let's say, the story is set 100 years ago, it feels still so relevant. And you can identify, you can perfectly feel this disorientation, this not belonging somewhere. This hesitating, what is going on with me? And this is something that happens to millions of people today. And just to realize that in those days was even illegal is something, at least this is something that for us in our Western societies, luckily we don't have to fear anymore. And this is what makes it maybe even more painful to think, oh my gosh, these people suffer so much back then, because they didn't have absolutely no way no way to leave their love, to leave what they felt for.
Oh,
it is so compelling. It's so moving. It is really so, so moving. And I am also not very familiar with many stories or many films with same-sex love. And I was mostly emotionally taken by this realization to feel, my gosh, this community is so underrepresented and how they struggle to find on screen stories that they can identify with.
Yeah.
Because out of 100 films, maybe there's just one or two that show same-sex stories. So,
yeah.
And what a struggle. What is that for a struggle? It really was very, very moving. How about you, Nene?
You
have a bigger filmography record, and you are always very brave, and you always explore into very different genres and different types of films. What was your impression about this love story of two men?
It was as you said, very, first of all, compelling, but also quite devastating for me. It's one of the reasons that, as period films go, this one was quite painful at times to watch. And I'm not saying that it's a dark movie in any way, but it's somber. You use the word somber. There's the, you know, and I love the word you use, the disorientation that the characters feel of, you know, should I giving into this love? And this is 1909. They're going to an all boys school. Their entire society is made of men, and of course, there's all these kinds of expectations. Like, you can kind of fool around a little bit, but later on, you're expected to, you know, leave all those games behind and get serious and get married and fulfill your role in society. It is very painful. I felt quite a lot of pain watching this movie for all those awkward moments. Awkward moments where they kind of realize that they're falling in love. And I think we can talk about that. I think we can talk about that scene, the key scene here.
The key scene. But hold on, we will certainly talk about that. Let's stay on the pain first.
The pain.
And the pain, because it is, as you mentioned, sometimes really cruel to kind of put yourself in his shoes in that moment or in this situation, completely trapped, and then you know that you cannot lose a word about that, because the consequences might be catastrophical. So there is one moment where he goes to a friend he's in a party, and he says, "I need to talk to you. Can you please give me some advice?" And he locks himself in a room with this man. He's a doctor, and he asks for his advice. He wants to just share this. He just wants to share what he's feeling and his doubts. And the guy was like, "There's nothing wrong with you, and get dressed and forget about, you know, whatever abnormality you're thinking of." You know, he really tried to wipe it all out. And in this moment, you are aware again of how trapped he must have felt, how horrible it must be for someone who just cannot even say it.
Yeah.
What he feels.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was his dad, in fact, who was
his dad. His dad. Okay.
So he goes to his dad, but the professional relationship at that moment. And we're talking about Maurice here. The thing is with the whole plot here, and how they each of them assume, Maurice and Clive, they assume it in a completely different way. Once they realize that they have these feelings, that they are gay, Maurice, he kind of struggles, because he would like to embrace this life. He would like to live as an out gay man. Obviously, he cannot do this. Mm. So the only solution that he can find is, okay, how do I change my nature? How do I cure myself of this? Because I can't. And the reason he's trying to do that is because at some point, after their romance, which we haven't talked about yet.
This is coming soon because
okay,
I have
this is
some...
coming in the next topic. We'll save it. We're gonna save it. After the romance between Maurice and Clive, he determined quite cruelly, quite coldly, determinedly that he will now live as a heterosexual man. He's gonna marry and he's gonna pursue a political life.
He had a very awakening experience that it, by chance he was at the trial of a man of a
viscount
of a yes who they knew he knew him from the uni and so on, and this man was caught kissing another man and was tried, and he witnesses the trial of this man and how he falls under the weight of the law by being caught kissing another man. And this moment shook him. And he said, obviously, in that moment, he decided for himself, and with a lot of suffering, because he also suffered when he realized that. Yeah, when he said, okay, I don't want to lose my status, my kind of life, what I'm meant to be, you know, my aristocracy, and so on and so on and so on. Mm. I have to drop this. I have to drop my gayness or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was like an awakening.
Yeah, that's right.
Experience.
Yeah, that's right. He went to the trial and it was a viscount. And so he was set in a trap. Somebody kind of got him to kiss him.
So he was ambushed.
Yeah, he was, and he has a complete, Clive has a complete mental collapse when he realizes, I can't go on with this. My whole plan for my future, which is pursue a political career and, mm-hmm. and maintain my name and keep my name respectable, my family's name respectable and my position, he determines that he cannot, and he's able to do it. He's able to do it. On the other hand, Maurice, he doesn't want to do that, but because Clive has already done this, he's like, well, I mean, what can I do?
Then there's something wrong with me. Yes.
There's something wrong with me. And he goes to this doctor who does some kind of hypnosis. He's absolutely repressed.
He's absolutely repressed.
In his being, oh my God. And this is so
his nature.
His nature. And this is so profoundly painful to watch living these lives closeted. It's just so, and it's just so subtle, but it's just, you can feel the weight of the lies,
of the oppression, of the repression, yes,
in their bodies. It's just so hard. But so essentially they show this period, this fear, this oppression very well in the movie. I think this is very well done, because
absolutely
we can see how this completely permeates every move they do, every decision they make, every word they say or not say, because it's so dangerous.
Yes, exactly. There's so much at risk that they can lose. Nene, so before we finish, we have to touch one more topic. We have to talk about something very, very important. We have talked about Maurice, his motivation, his struggles. We have talked about Clive and his motivations and his struggles for his career and so on. But how about the two of them together? Let's talk about the love story. Did this love story, this the connection between Clive and Maurice, really spark for you?
Oh my God, you really let me talk about the love story finally.
Go, be my guest. I'm very critical, but so go ahead.
Are you critical of this?
Totally.
This romance? Are you kidding me? Oh my God. I mean, okay, let's up front here that the performances are extraordinary. You do feel the awkwardness of the performance. But I think it adds to their own awkward feelings, to their own insecurities, like, does he love me, does he not? So we have a to the key scene in the movie. And again, don't listen to this podcast before you see the movie. If you see the movie and then come back to the podcast. Because they've been kind of fooling around. They've been playing around. Their classmates, they study together. They discuss works of philosophy together. There's an amazing scene where they play piano. And they hide, you can start to see that they hide a lot of their touches, like the excuses to touch each other, to be with each other. They hide it behind, you know, boyful banter and boyful, like play, like punching each other. Like, it's so different from women, you know. Boys will show up physically. They will punch each other. They will throw you in the ground, roll you in a carpet. And it's all supposed to be, you know, play, like, play fighting.
Fighting, yeah.
Yeah, and this is all just masculine ways of showing, of being physical, in quote unquote, you know, just masculine, but it's actually very erotic and it's just kind of like foreplay.
This is
done for me, and you said you were very critical. I am not. For me, it was very, you can see the awkwardness of the actors, but I think that added to the, you know, how awkward they felt, because they were like, oh, does he feel the same way I do? Or like they're questioning each other. It's like, is he going to accept what I'm going to do right now? It's like the insecurity is like, maybe I think he likes me, but I'm not entirely sure how he's going to take this if I touch him. And that takes us to the very key, most beautiful, most spectacular scene in the whole movie, where they're sitting in one of their rooms. I don't know which ones. And Maurice is sitting on a chair and Clive is sitting by his feet, and they're both looking in the same direction. So they're not looking at each other.
And Clive had his head.
Yeah, so Clive has his head like leaning on Maurice's leg. And they're talking. I don't even remember what they're talking about. I forgot.
It's not relevant.
and then, oh my God, I even describing it, I get shivers. And then Maurice very gently starts to caress Clive's hair. Oh my God, the hair.
Have we mentioned the hair?
Lordy Lord. This is beautiful. This is so beautiful. This is extremely sexy and just charged with energy and the fear, like, because you see Hugh, oh my God, that moment of Hugh Grant, his face, he's acting in that moment where he's like, oh my God, what's happening? Just brilliant.
Brilliant.
So that's the peak one. They have a couple ones like rolling in the hay a little bit. Very importantly, it is never realized their love, because Clive, he has been reading Plato and he believes that the relationship should be platonic,
mm-hmm.
that they should not have sex.
Exactly, because that would ruin everything. I completely agree that this scene of them sitting together and how he caresses the hair of Clive, it is just really magical. And then they hug. Beware of spoilers. They hug very tenderly. They hug very carefully and tenderly. And that's where Maurice realizes how it feels to hug another man. His expression is like, you see like three different faces or three different emotions going through his face, because he's so surprised by how good it feels when he gets hugged by Clive. Yeah. So here comes my butt.
Okay.
Here comes my butt. I think it went too fast. So this entire foreplay that they have, of course, you see them and they giggle here and they share some classes and they play piano together and so on and so on. But from one moment to the other, they're in love. So it, for me, this, it had to, for me, it had to be more, I don't know. It needed more development. Mm. The love between them was not believable to me as a viewer. I know Maurice's motivation, what he comes from, what he feels, what he struggles with. And I know Clive and what he feels, and this exactly this playful platonic kind of thing. Perfect. But why are they all of a sudden, after 3-4 scenes where they're just fooling each other, they just, you know, like for Maurice, it's just like, this is the love of my life. It went too fast for me. It really, really went too fast for me. And this is why I was like, okay, is this really just like, this is the love story? And again, I perfectly understand both characters. Yeah. But their connection was not really there for me.
Oh,
yeah. That made me even think, maybe to kind of justify, why is it that I didn't really feel it like it was like the love story between them? That Maurice was just like in love with the idea of loving someone.
Yeah.
You know? And not, it could have been someone else, which happens actually later on as well, you know? It could have been just another man. It didn't have to be Clive, you know? But he kind of loved him because of what he showed to him, you
yeah.
know? Oh. That he made him aware of, okay, this is what I like and this is what I love and this is yes. how I feel. And it wasn't really about Clive himself.
Yeah, no. In that, I agree with you. I think it's, you know, he couldn't experiment. He couldn't go kissing other girls. This is the very first person that he dared to show some tenderness in that way that responds back. So
yes.
I absolutely agree that it's not particularly Clive that he loved, but this is the first boy.
Yes.
That has responded to him and it's like, okay.
Like, yeah, opening this window.
Opening this window of possibilities to him.
Possibility.
I think they do like each other a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, they do, you know, they do like each other a lot, especially that scene where they're playing the piano, both of them. They share an apple and they're playing, and it's just so playful and so wonderfully done. For me, it wasn't that fast. For me, the pace was fine. It was believable. But I think it's important to remember that this is not the main love story in the movie. There's another one, which is the true love story. And that one, for me, is the less believable one.
Totally and less believable.
And much less believable.
And then I also think, but please describe the relationship and then I tell you what I think about it.
Well, yeah, so what happens is, you know, Clive decides to get married with a woman and live a straight life, let's put it that way. And yeah, and he's very successful in his political career. He has a loving wife. In fact, I mean, he's, you know, he's okay. He seems to be doing okay. And they invite Maurice to stay with them in their house. He's still single. And he stays there for long periods of time in their house with them. And that's where he meets the caretaker. Caretaker, I think he is. Or,
yes, yes.
Yeah, just a worker in the house, Alec, who's played by?
Wonderful Rupert Graves.
Yes, the wonderful Rupert Graves. And I think this was just like his second role.
Yes.
And I think you can tell a little bit.
Well, I read somewhere, please apologize that I'm not really giving this as accurate as I should. I read somewhere that he was not really happy with his performance in A Room with a View.
Yes.
So he asked for another chance to get a bigger role because he wanted really to show what he can do. And this is why they casted him for this role. And he was very happy with that.
Yeah, you know what? The thing is, okay, so let's complete the description.
The story.
So essentially, Maurice is now, you know, he's accepted that Clive is living his life that way. And then, you know, this servant, this caretaker, comes on to him. And I said, I know what you are. I know who you are. I know he kind of, there's a whole scene where he climbs the stair and he goes into, there's there's a lot of beautiful scenes here. There's a scene where Maurice is staying at Clive's house and he's feeling so trapped, so desperate with his life, right? That he opens the windows and he takes his head out and the window and he gets all wet with the rain.
Yes.
Oh God, like the feeling that he needs to be liberated in some way.
Yes.
And
yes.
Lurking. And from the woods, there's Alec and he witnessed this scene and somehow he knows this is my man.
Yes.
They can smell each other in a way.
Yeah,
I don't even know how to explain it, but he guesses right and he climbs the stair, he goes to his window, and Alec finally shows Maurice what it is to have to make love
to make love
man. Because he was not consummated in any way. And
no.
these scenes are more not explicit, but these are proper love scenes where there's clothing taken off, naked bodies, kissing, mm-hmm. conversations in bed. So these are proper love scenes. And I think they're fine. I think they're
very
they're
okay. elegant. Yeah, yes. They're very well done. Yes.
They're very well done, but it's still for me this relationship is less believable than Maurice.
Totally. I agree with you 200%.
It could be the social class difference. I'm not sure.
Here again, I think that Maurice is just captivated by Alec's free-spirited style,
yes.
and what he represents, that he can just live his nature with Alec. It's not about Alec.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't really love the person Alec or his personality or his character or his, you know, soul or whatever, his mind. It's not a connection of the mind. He is in love with what Alec represents to him for his life, that he is able to live his nature, his true feelings with Alec. It's not about the person. It's just about what he represents.
Yeah, I agree with you because it's only the very second person that he can be himself with. It's just the very second person that's giving him the opportunity to be himself.
Yes, to be himself, exactly.
Himself. So, yeah, but still very beautiful. I think it's still a very, James Wilby's performance is great throughout. I will say Rupert Gray's performance is a little more shaky. He's gorgeous. He's so beautiful. And yeah, he represents a very free spirit, like as opposed to Maurice and Clive. He is fully okay with who he is. He's fully okay with his sexuality, his orientation. He's fully okay with feeling pleasure. He's not haunted by, you know, what consequences this might bring to his life.
Mm-hmm.
He has
nothing to lose. Alec doesn't have much to lose.
Well, he was supposed to go to Argentina, to Buenos Aires, and he gave up the plan. The plans change. So there were some consequences for him.
But you know, he wouldn't lose as much as someone like Clive. He wouldn't lose status. He wouldn't lose reputation or a name or inheritance or whatever, you know?
Yeah, or he's
there was much less at stake for Alec as a caretaker as for Clive Durham of high class society.
So he has a freedom that the other two cannot afford.
But
again, I mean, everywhere I read about this movie, they said this is a movie with James Ivory said and what Ian Foster had said, they wanted a story with a happy ending. So this is supposed to be a happy ending in which Maurice finds himself and ends up with the person that he's going to spend his life. Still, for me, doesn't feel so happy because of what we're saying. Does he really love him? Or is this going to last?
Is it going to last forever? But, we can just speculate. Of course, we are now free to make the ending as we want it because the film ends there, so we can imagine the rest. And we can just maybe think that Maurice will grow into this, you know? He will develop, he will maybe there even more throughout his life and find ways after he has first explored this and discovered this. This is exactly what I like and what I love, and this is how I feel, and this is my nature. Maybe he finds a way with age and with time to find real love. But somebody had to kind of show him how it feels.
Yeah, and Alec did that for him.
And Alec was like the door opener, kind of.
Yeah. So before we conclude our discussion, I saw a lot of the conversations around this movie was about the dichotomy between living an honest life and living a dishonest life. So the difference is, you know, Clive Durham, I can say the name, he decides to live a dishonest life. Because he's hiding his true nature by following the rules of society, getting married, having a political life, and so on. And Maurice is a much more admirable character because he decides, he has the courage to live an honest life. What do you think of this?
Well, we have to define honest and dishonest a little bit more carefully. I think it's maybe more rational or true. Yeah, Clive went the rational way. Maybe it's not really, he is maybe being dishonest to himself, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously when he sees at the very end, he sees through the window, he sees Maurice walking away, and he knows that he's meeting Alec somewhere in the woods, and he is nostalgic about that. You know, you see that he is kind of having these thoughts of, I admire Maurice for this, for taking the courage, as you mentioned, for taking the courage of living his true life. Yeah, he's kind of like, okay, I didn't dare to do that myself. I chickened out. I went for the rational way. So he is living with a lie for himself.
Yeah.
And Maurice, I wouldn't say that he's going for the honest life. He will have to be in hiding for the rest of his life. He will always love men, but it will always have to be a secret. We know that because until very late, homosexuality was still illegal. So we can imagine that for this character, it was love always in hiding.
Yeah.
You know, but it was true to his soul and it was true to himself. And this is the choice he made in that moment to say, okay, I don't care about the consequences. Maybe he managed to find a way, but he said, okay, I'm going to live true to my soul, true to myself.
I think the honesty that we're talking about is honesty
is that,
with
maybe,
yourself. Obviously with society, I don't think there were many honest people at the time.
Both failed.
Especially in the Edwardian England, because it was such a restrictive society with so many rules for everybody, for not just aristocratic people or women, for everybody, for the roles that each person had to fulfill. So to live an honest life at that time probably wasn't that easy, like honest with yourself, that you're at peace with your
with yes mission. That's true. It's essentially more the exception as a rule. Yes.
Yeah. So, but we are to understand that Maurice, you know, he has allowed himself to be himself, and I think in 1909, just the before the war, just this fact is a triumph, right? Just to be able to be honest with himself, at least with himself,
is a
win. Is in that society, in that context, is a win.
An achievement, yes,
an achievement. Yeah, I mean, this topic is fascinating, and I think it's one of the reasons why period films continue to be fascinating to me, and I think to you as well, is because how did people navigate these restrictions? How did people navigate their societies and the restrictions that their societies put on them? Because
the challenges.
Yes. Yeah, the challenges, because today we live in a much more open society, but we did struggle with certain restrictions when we were growing up, because Venezuelan society is very conservative. We have said this before, mainly Catholic. So a lot of challenges too, if you are a little bit more free spirited. Of course, this is getting better now. We're in 2021. Mm. And not going too far, there's a lot of countries, different societies, where still, if we speak specifically about LGBTQ 2+ people, they're still struggling. They're still, you know, in some places it's still viewed as illegal. You can be hung, taken to jail. I mean, there's so many horrors happening in this world still.
And and maybe that's, of course, the extreme, but and maybe in our societies, they might not go to jail, but there's still a lot of stigma and a lot of tabuization. It's still a lot of taboo around it, you know?
Yeah.
So we're still not there yet. And this is what makes it so relevant today. Yeah?
It is very relevant. It's still super relevant because I live in North America, I live in Canada, and Canada is a very modern society, very progressive society. So you wouldn't think that this will still be happening. All this, there's still a stigma. There's still, everybody has to go through their own process. But there's countries like, if we go back to Venezuela, where there's still huge amount of homophobia.
A lot.
Huge amount of homophobia. So for some people on the planet, this has not gotten easier. For some people it has, but for a lot of people it has not gotten easier. But if we see it from the perspective of, you know, I live in North America, things have improved a lot. This takes me to the past and show me how bad it was before. It makes me happy that I live
and
here
how far
now.
We've come so far. Yes,
how
of course.
Far we've come. How far we've
how
come,
far we've
which,
come
which
so far.
Which makes me happy. But it's always fascinating to see, you know, the stories of people trying to go against their times and how difficult that was and how painful that was
how
and
painful.
How some people managed to do it and some people did not.
How many of them maybe just broke under the weight of the repression of the constraints of society.
Exactly. Had to live in darkness their entire lives. How sad that is.
How sad because now that we are, as you mentioned, 2021, you live in North America, I live in Europe, I live in Germany, very open society. It is unthinkable for us not to be able to express something like that. It is unthinkable for countries where same-sex marriage is already, you know, normal.
Yeah.
And this is like the most excruciating part of the entire story.
Yeah, that is.
Imagine how many people went through that fate back then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the weight of the story. Like after you finish seeing the movie and you imagine, my goodness, it took almost another 100 years
for this to become kind of normal.
Normal, yeah. So
kind
so,
of because it's
so
not.
So you imagine
100%
the decades of so the suffering of millions of people. Mm-hmm. You imagine the weight of that. It's like if it weighs in your soul. It's like it's heavy. Like my goodness, it takes a, you know, if you're there, it's gonna take a long time before same-sex marriage is approved and
it's approved and you can live your love.
Well, Gabby, this has been a really fascinating discussion. I mean, I didn't expect this movie to touch me so much, to give me so much to think about, rediscovering Hugh Grant and how
rediscovering Hugh Grant,
how beautiful he was. What a performance. And how unusual this period film is. It's very much a British period movie, but different at the same time.
Yes. Okay, then, so the question of the questions is, how many wicks and candles do you give Morris?
Gosh, I'm going to be, I always struggle with wicks and candles because it's very hard for me to rate movies because I try to see all of their shades. I'm going to give an 8 to Morris. And here is why. I felt the performances, especially Rupert Graves, were a little awkward. And that took me out of the story a little bit. the performances of Hugh Grant and James Wilby were impeccable. But that kind of like last third of the movie with Rupert Graves and that relationship, it wasn't as believable to me. So that took away a little bit. Also, I think that is all. I think all the rest is really, really compelling and beautiful. But I think I was just so sad. I was just so sad. There's a somber mood in the whole movie that no matter how many beautiful costumes and how many beautiful settings and the gorgeous Cambridge settings and the rooms and the whole school uniform stuff, it cannot take me out of that sadness. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I give it 8, because if I base it on pleasure, yeah, I enjoyed it. But I also felt quite pained for them, for the characters.
There has to be some drama. Nene, we agree on the rating. I guess I'm going to give it an 8. I thought about this before we met, because I knew the question would come. I'm also going to give it an 8. And for me, the downer was this, as I mentioned, this how he fell in love with Clive, with Hugh Grant's character, was too fast for me. And I really, really had the time to kind of get into to get into the mood and also kind of fall in love, you know, because usually when you see a love story and you see the development between the two persons, then you can kind of also fall in love yourself, you know. I didn't feel that. As I said, the individually, each character and each actor, the performances, absolutely wonderful. But this also kind of took the kind of like the magic of the story. And also the love relationship he has at the end with Alex. So I had to fantasize myself. I had to speculate myself a justification on why he fell in love with these two men, because it was not given through the story, you know? So I had to make it up myself. Yeah, he loved Alec because of what he represented, but it's not really like it doesn't become clear through the story. It doesn't become clear through the movie that it's not really a love of the minds and of the souls, but of this freedom that he feels. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna go for an 8. It is wonderful. It as you mentioned, it impacted me in many levels that I wasn't expecting. Mm-hmm. I liked it even more than what I was expecting. There are many scenes that really took me by, really emotionally. As I mentioned, the one where he talks to his father, how he cries there. That was so moving. It is really, really, really compelling. I really liked it a lot. Yeah. I'm going to recommend it if somebody asks me. I'm going to recommend it. And maybe one more thing. It was a tad long. And this is unusual because films in those days, they went straight to the point. Mm. If you look at film history throughout the last 20, 30 years, films are getting longer.
Yeah.
Always longer. Yeah. You know, there's rarely a film that is under 2 hours. And this is for me unusual that already a film back then in 1987 was over 2 hours long. Mm. So I think that sometimes it took too long to tell the story.
So a little bit of editing there.
Yes.
Yeah, so it dragged a little bit. Yeah, I agree with that. What I want to recommend this movie as well, especially if you're a period film lover. What I feel that we have done is we have done our homework. We have watched one of the key movies in the Merchant Ivory series of movies, so it was an absolute must. We had to watch it. It's a classic, and I think at the time it was an important movie.
Yes, of course. This happened 35 years ago. Yes.
Yeah, the director with James Ivory, he mentioned that this movie came out at the height of the AIDS epidemic. In fact, something that surprised him is that no one dared to criticize the movie in any negative way, in the sense that this is immoral, this movie shouldn't come out. It was a moment in history where this movie had to come out, and it had its place. And I'm so happy that it was the Merchant Ivory production company that took on the story, because it's beautiful to watch.
It's so subtle. Maybe, and alone for that fact, Nene, alone for that fact, this movie is a classic.
Yeah, it is a total classic. And I think it has been remastered. It was remastered
2020.
In 2020. So it wasn't easy to find for me. I had it on YouTube, but I think it can be purchased or rented in, depending on the country. But I think a remastered version around that you can access.
Absolutely anyway. Worth watching.
Anyway, Gabby, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your
insight.
I enjoyed it so much.
Me too, Nene. Thank you for your inspiration. And your insight is also it's also so interesting. Maybe we have to mention, we never talk about our opinions on the films until we meet for the podcast. So we always figure out what we think about the film, just why we are
live
talking about it. Yes. Makes it exciting
on the fly. Well, but that's what we do. Is you have to keep the conversation interesting. They have to be fireworks.
Yes.
Anyway, well, everybody who's listened, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you stay tuned for the next episode.
Yes, we hope you enjoy it. Bye-bye.
Wicks and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Wicks and Candles. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
Wicks and Candles is written, hosted, and produced by Andreina Romero and Gabriela Mocken Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rollin. The podcast theme music is the Concerto for Two Violins in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.